So of course, when we're unwilling or unable to stay with the truth of impermanence, insubstantiality, then we're going to have all sorts of strategies, very highly developed strategies, to ricochet into, which are basically eternalism, nihilism, the past and the future. And so these are all habitual reactions and ways of avoiding being with the naked truth of whatever we are experiencing in the moment. So in a way, they're like a blindfold that prevents us facing what is staring us in the face. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about eternalism and nihilism. I know this is probably pretty basic stuff to lots of you, but I think it's quite good just to look at what we do. You might recognise a few things. So I think when we're under the sway of eternalism, that we bargain with life and we turn our spiritual practice into an insurance policy approach to spiritual life. So we're building up credit that we're going to reap later on, hopefully. And I think what we often do is very subtle, but we think if we follow spiritual life, we'll avoid suffering. So we're wanting a payoff of avoiding the difficulties of life. We might avoid reactive suffering, hopefully we will, because we won't be reacting, but we're not going to avoid things going wrong in life, because things do go wrong in life. We're all going to be subject to sickness, old age and death. We're going to have money in the stock market that goes down the pan, maybe. We're going to have family that die. We're going to get ill. We're going to go out at the end of the convention and discover our car's got a flat tyre. You know, there's all kinds of things that samsara throws at us, and no amount of Buddhist practice is going to stop that happening. So I think it's quite interesting to look at, do you have that as a subtle motivation for your spiritual life, that somehow you're going to be able to get things on your own terms? So it's the view of the optimist who follows the spiritual life to strike some kind of deal with reality that will protect from harm. I also think it's the view of the person who lives under the tyranny of hope as a refuge. Hope's a very, very interesting area to look at. Hope in the sense of always being in the future, wanting some different experience than what's in the present. I think hope can be good sometimes, but I think it's also not a terribly spiritual quality, actually, hope. And I think if one's eternalist, it can lead to a lot of mental and physical strain and tension because you're straining to be in the future when things are going to be better. And I know that because I'm an eternalist by nature, and it does lead to a lot of tension. And I think it's just to talk a bit more about this, I think actually we can be remarkably successful at manipulating samsara. We can get really adept at it. Particularly with a bit of awareness, we're Buddhists, we're kind of basically healthy probably, we're probably quite happy. We've got more confident. So we're able to negotiate with samsara often very well, very effectively. But this is the point, picking a point from Kula Prabha's talk, that being happy isn't enough. So I do think we need to also guard against settling down with just being able to manage life quite a lot better than we used to be able to, and going to sleep a little bit. And I think the subtle eternalism can be very, very seductive and hard to spot. So we think life is okay today, more or less, and tomorrow it might be even better if I juggle a few things around, do a little bit of shunting around at the different aspects of my life. And when you do that, you're not really facing up to the fact that samsara is never going to be totally okay. So I think we can spend years trying to just get it all working nicely on its own level and not really plunge deeply into the fact that, hey, this is never going to be completely navigable on its own level. And I think it's interesting that maybe for us, we have there's an interesting paradox as women, Western women on the whole, sitting here, 21st century. We've probably got, for many of us, historically unrivaled conditions for practicing the Dharma as women, which is worth thinking about. We've got material comfort, we've got enough food, we've got enough money. I would say all of us have probably got enough money to get by, even if we feel poor. We live in a free democracies, most of us, with religious freedom, particularly if we're not Muslims at the moment. So as Buddhists, we've got religious freedom. We've got access to contraception, which means we've got choice about childbirth, which is very recent. Women have never had that before the last 50 years. We've got the possibility of financial independence. Really, we can do what we like. My conditioning as a New Zealand girl growing up was, you can do whatever you like with your life. The world is your oyster. Get out there, grab it, make the most of it. I don't think that's true of many women in history. But I think paradoxically, that makes it easier for us to settle down. Because actually it is relatively quite easy, even if we might feel it's hard. Relatively, it's not that hard a life most of us have got in practical terms. And so I think this can lull us into a false sense of security, because actually turning around and looking reality in the face, that's really hard. That's practicing spiritual life is really hard. So if we've got the option of doing that, then maybe thinking, actually this isn't so bad. You know, what I've got isn't so bad. It's quite a hard choice to make. So I think there's an interesting paradox that the opportunities that we've got are the very things that can also lull us to sleep as modern practitioners. I mean, I see this myself, you know, can I really bother getting out of bed to meditate? And I often, well, not often, sometimes I don't get out of bed to meditate. If I really was serious about, you know, really wanting to see into the truth, I would get out of bed to meditate. So I think, you know, it is interesting just to look at this area. And Sadhanandi raised a question in a little talk she gave a few days ago, where she wondered whether we're not demanding enough with ourselves. So I think that is also a good thing to think about. So nihilism, of course, at the other extreme of this trying to get it all just hanging together nicely, so it's all okay, is nihilism, which I'm sure we're also probably familiar with. And it's very easy to get into nihilism around this area of spiritual death. It's a definite trap for many of us to fall into. And of course, this is more pessimistic and hopeless. So it's an absence of hope in the negative sense. Where we think, if everything is changing and I'm just going to die one day, then what's the point in bothering? What is the point in practicing the spiritual life? What's the point in embracing life? Because it's all just going to end in dust. So this is an interesting thing to look at as well. And it can seem as if everything we touch turns to dust as it is empty of security. And this does become very life-denying and bleak. And taken to extremes, it can include a sense where one can start to doubt one's very existence at all. You can start to think, am I making myself up? I mean, I've gone there a bit, I must say. So you can start to get quite heady and think, well, if everything's impermanent, everything's insubstantial, then who am I? I'm making myself up, it's all just a figment of my imagination. And then you can get really in a bad state, let me tell you. So it can be very destabilising and scary when you go down that route. But I think it's interesting to realise that's a view, that's ideas that are not grounded in your experience in the moment. Because if one gets out of one's head these thoughts, who am I real, am I making myself up, etc., etc., and you think, well, what is my actual experience? Then relatively, one is breathing, one's got a body, there's the body on the chair. So that all these sensations on a moment-by-moment thought, they are very real. You know, we're not making those up. Those are absolutely, actually grounded, actual experiences in our body. And I think this comes to the interesting point that we need to remember that anatta doesn't mean that one doesn't exist at all. It just means that we haven't got a fixed and unchanging essence, which is obviously a very important distinction to make. And I often use the phrase, all things are full of emptiness, to help me counter views that are nihilistic. I find it really, really helpful. All things are full of emptiness. So there's a kind of fullness aspect to it rather than an annihilationist aspect to it.